You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. And if you haven't subscribed to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, you can always hit subscribe so the show appears magically, automatically in your podcast folder. And please do so, because during the month of December, I'm going to give you a very special treat, but I'm only going to pop it on the RSS feed. I don't want to blind you with science, but there's a thing called an RSS feed. I don't know what it is. I'm going to put a special treat on there for podcast listeners, and then I'm going to take it away again. So make sure you're subscribed if you'd like a little Christmas present from me, something that has genuine cash value. Make sure you're subscribed to this show, and throughout the whole month of December, at one point, I'll be dropping for a week or so a little treat. So make sure you are subscribed. Now, a tiny giant of UK comedy. I've been after this man for a long time, and I mean, he's not the first person to appear on this show who had to be convinced, but I think he's the first person on the show who declined and then was told off and then agreed. It's Andy Askins.
To begin on a slightly interesting tone, when you agreed to do the show, it was very sweet. You sent me, I invited you via Facebook, and you said, you very, very politely bowed out and said, actually, I'm not very comfortable talking about myself. And then 20 minutes later, you messaged me back and said, all right, I've been told off, I'll do it. Tell me about that.
Oh, I don't wear the trousers. That's a simple fact. In my house, and I was talking to my beautiful wife Julie, who may not listen to this. I told her about the podcast and how it was really well received and very popular. And I was on it. I just don't think people would like to listen to me for droning on in my monotone voice, and I don't find myself particularly I hate talking about myself, that's what it is.
Okay.
And my wife said, don't be so stupid, you're a grown man, do the podcast. So
I love it. I think you're the first guest I've had who's doing the show under duress. I'm going to start employing your wife to bully other comics into coming on the show.
She'd do a grand job.
There's something really interesting about there's loads of stuff to talk about with your act and what makes you so unique. One of the things that I love, and I think your audiences love, is you have such gentleness. You play such a low status person on stage, and I wanted to begin with I don't know if you still use this as an opening line, but the charisma line, could you just, I don't want you to butcher it, I know this isn't a gig, but can you just tell us what the line is, because it's one of my favorite opening lines ever.
It's just hi, my name is Andy Askins. You've probably already gathered I have absolutely no charisma.
When did you start using that line? Well, how did that come about?
I know how I look on stage. I know I look terrible. And I got so fed up with people being aghast when I walked out with disappointment. I was quite numb sometimes inside. It was like, and you would hear them going, oh my God, oh, the poor fella. And it was quite distracting for the rest of the audience. So I just decided to make more of it. And I do look like I am the grey man, I think it's called in certain circles. You know, I could be stood behind you and you would never notice me. You would never know as a comedian anywhere. Nobody ever guesses. Everybody's shocked. People think I'm lying when I say I do comedy. So yeah, I'm just playing on that, really.
It's a very unusual quality. I don't know that I entirely agree with you that you're a grey man. I think you've... I think it would be quite offensive if I went, oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. You certainly... I can believe that people don't believe that you're a comic. There's definitely a quality you have where you like...
Absolutely.
I'm really interested in why that isn't a more common trait, because who says anyone knows what a comic looks like?
Yeah, you are right. I think it's probably because I'm quite an introverted person and I'm not a flamboyant. I'm so dry in my comments. You know, a lot of people miss my comments or jokes just because they're just so dry.
Yeah.
Really.
I've noticed that. Like, in your act, there are lines where... There's lines which are very, like, overtly comic lines. Mm-hmm. And then there are kind of tags which... Some people, some audiences, you... And I've seen... Absolutely, I've seen ones where everyone's, you know, getting everything. But there are some times when something is... It's not quite blink and you miss it, but people just don't notice that it's a joke. And the comics are killing themselves because it's so subtle.
I think comics are infinitely more attuned to lines, aren't they? They hear everything, they see beforehand what's coming the majority of the time. And audiences, I think they are used to punchlines being delivered in a punchline way and exaggerated, whereas quite often... Possibly just because of my accent, there's no really ups or downs in when I talk. It's just talking. And there it is, and hope you find it.
It's not just the accent. It's to do with the subtlety. Like, the subtlety is what the people who do laugh at those lines are enjoying.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Again, I can't explain it. I wish I knew how it all worked. I say stuff and people laugh, hopefully. I wish I could be more helpful.
That's all right. No.
I told you, this is...
No. Don't panic at all. This is my... You don't need to worry at all. My job is to get the stuff out of you. So let's take it as a blanket apology. Andy doesn't want to be here and doesn't think he has anything interesting to say. Let's just assume that you think that's fine. You don't need to keep saying that.
God bless you, Stuart.
So can you think of a particular tag or line of yours that is iffy as to whether or not they'll notice it, just so that we can talk about in a bit more detail about the specific one that
there's a gag that gets lost quite a lot, and it's just a simple gag, and it's the one I do about I have two beautiful children, and that gets lost an awful lot of time. And I think I'm hammering out with a sledgehammer, really. That's how it feels in my head. But people miss it, and it's just, it gets nothing sometimes. But, and other times, people
it just brings the house down because people get it. Here's another aspect of your position you take in relation to us on stage. You get away with some really mean jokes, or I don't know. They're kind of mean, is the right word. I mean, they're jokes, obviously.
Yes.
But because they're being delivered by someone so apparently defenseless.
Yeah. My humour, it is, it's shocking, really. And it's the things I talk about behaving in a way that I'm the polar opposite to. I just switch things around. And I'm saying things that if I heard somebody saying for real, I'd be completely appalled. And it makes me laugh, and I say them and people laugh, and that's it. And
Can you give us an example of like the worst thing that you'd say?
No, not really.
Or does it feel like you'd be embarrassed to say it out of a performative context?
I feel as though on stage I'm sort of a character. I'm a character. Part of it is me and part of it is this person who I abhor. And part of it is a person who I'd secretly like to be.
That's interesting. Yeah. Why is that? I mean, I'd really like to look at that idea of it. Part of it is someone that you'd really like to be. What? Because that person is confident and extroverted?
Yeah.
Or what? What qualities?
Yeah, some of the things I say, I'm talking about myself in sort of like a third person, which feels really uncomfortable. But some of the things I say on stage... if I heard a blokey bloke talking about that in the pub, I'd think, oh, he's pretty cool. Don't like him, but it sounds cool. You know, all the macho stuff.
Go on.
Yeah, so that aspect, sometimes I think, oh, I wish I was a bit more Crocodile Dundee, and but I'm not bothered. Be quite happy licking envelopes. Carefully.
So let's talk about your discovery of comedy. How did you first come across comedy?
Well, from a little lad, I suppose my first exposure to it, or proper exposure, was movies, and then later on, Billy Connolly. He was very popular when I was a kid, and I saw him, and I was amazed when I watched his movie Big Banana Feet on the cinema. And yeah, I've always enjoyed laughing and making people laugh.
Okay.
But it was never on the horizon, me becoming a comedian, not at all.
What was on the horizon? Do you remember what you anticipated from your future?
I'm a drifter. I've never particularly had any goals, just to be happy. Yeah, that's all my life. I haven't thought I want to be a doctor, I want to be this, that, or the other. I've just wanted to be happy. So I've drifted from job to job and jumped on things that I thought might be good or interesting and enjoy. And it's continued. There have been times in my life where I've done some god-awful jobs, really awful jobs. But let's get me out of that situation and do something I enjoy. That's always been my sort of like philosophy.
Were you a funny kid? Did you make your friends laugh at school?
Yeah. I'm. I don't want to sound pretentious, but no, I really enjoy making people laugh now, especially in a small social kind of way. It's my family, that's what I live and die for, making them laugh. From the getting up in the morning to going to bed at night.
And what are the differences between the humour that you have with your family and the humour that you do on stage?
I'm much more extrovert in my little bubble.
Are you?
Yes. If I can embarrass my kids, I'll quite happily pirouette right the way across a petrol four station in front of everybody just to see them all crouch down in the car. Yeah, that really makes me happy.
That's very interesting that without the intention being to make your family laugh, you would never dream of pirouetting across a forecourt. So what's different in the way, presumably your introversion, it's almost like the making people laugh is a sort of a gateway out of your introversion. Is that fair to say?
It might be fair to say. It's something I've never even thought of. I just feel very comfortable in small situations making people. It's changed now because I'm a comedian, and when people introduce me as a comedian, there are certain expectations which immediately puts me on my back foot a little bit.
Yeah, right.
And I don't want to sort of like underwhelm people. So I just keep me gob shut. But people I know, yeah, I love making people laugh. It's the best feeling in the world.
I'm just interested in this idea of you, just that very funny image of you pirouetting across a forecourt. Just as a thought experiment, if you were, like, could you do that to make your children laugh if they weren't there, if they were, say, watching on a video camera?
Yes, you
could do that.
I would
if they were
do
watching.
That. Yeah, to make them laugh, I would do that. Yes.
Okay, so even if they weren't there, you'd do it.
Yeah.
If it was to make them laugh, and if someone told you afterwards, "Oh, the video camera didn't work,"
I'd be horrified.
You'd be horrified. That's so interesting. Don't you think that the fact of that intention totally changes the scenario? But from the point of view of some bloke who doesn't know you looking at you. Yeah. It's the same, isn't it?
Yeah. He doesn't know. Yeah. And I am weird. Yeah. I am very strange.
So I felt that you slightly shied away from that question about making your friends laugh. Is that, and the sense I got was that you didn't want to go, "Oh yeah, I was a funny kid."
I suppose I was quite funny when I was a kid. I remember making everybody, I was a class clown. I remember on my school reports being useless at everything, and one report said he would be a fantastic comedian or something. I was only very small, and I got lots of that through my life. It was just a class clown, really.
A lot of people, I think, who are a class clown kind of character do it because it makes them safe, or it gives them status, or, you know, or maybe just because it makes them happy. Can you remember what was kind of underpinning it?
Oh, this
what
is like you, psychotherapy, really, isn't it?
You are on a leather couch, as accidental.
Yeah, I just wish I wasn't laid down. I'm trying to think back, and yeah, it was it for attention? I'm not sure. Perhaps I just wanted to be liked. No idea. I just remember being, people laughing all the time, and the teachers as well, really. I was never like a facetious kind of joker. It was always light-hearted stuff and self-deprecating, I remember. I was the world's best loser, if I remember rightly.
That's fascinating, because that's not something kids do a lot of.
Yeah, I was fantastic at losing and coming second by a hair's breadth and then hugging the person that beat me. I was shocking. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I don't know that I've heard another person talk about being a funny loser as a kid, because that's such a comic archetype, isn't it? You think of like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and stuff. It's about stuff going badly for you.
Yeah. Well, perhaps, I don't know why. I must admit, things like sport was a big part of my life. And I remember taking things a bit more seriously and then wanting to win and not enjoying it as much.
Yeah.
I was winning all the time, but I just wasn't the same, didn't enjoy it, yeah.
And did you do any kind of performance at school, anything like that?
Yeah, I did one or two little bits. It was normally teachers would twist my arm up my back, or I'd be threatened if I didn't perform. So I must have had something in that kind of... I played the guitar when I was a kid, and I was... not prodigious, but I was very good at an early age. I played lots of complicated classical guitar and ragtime and things, and used to perform in like a little performing monkey. It was all good. I loved it, yeah. But I was much happier performing it in my bedroom.
Why would they need to twist your arm to get you to do it if you were good and you enjoyed making people happy?
Probably the same reason I was a bit wary about doing this podcast. I've always been the same, you know. I don't really like standing up in front of, it is a bit weird, isn't it, standing up in front of people and being judged. That's what you're essentially being done, aren't you, on what you do on that stage or in front of those people. And I would much rather sit at the back. I wouldn't even like to sit at the front of the audience, sit at the back and watch somebody and cheer them along, really.
Do you remember the first comedy gig that you went to, first live comedy?
Yeah, do you know, I hardly remember it. It was the Comedy Store, actually, when it was in the old venue, and me and Julie were just walking through London, and I sort of went, oh, that's the Comedy Store, it's really famous, let's go in. And we went down these stairs, and it was little school chairs. And to be honest, all I remember really is the first guy had a guitar, and he was really having a tough time. He was getting heckled, and that's all I remember. And then the second time I watched a gig was somewhere around the Croydon area. And my friend said, oh, you've got to come to this comedy club, it's fantastic. And he was describing Harry Hill, who was a regular there.
Yeah.
And I went down this one night, and it was really funny and it was good. Harry Hill wasn't on that night, but I just thought, oh, that's great. But I never thought I'd ever get up on the stage, ever. And that was years before I even thought about comedy.
So what changed then? What was it that made you get up for your first ever gig?
Well, to be honest, again, it was an accident. And this thing about drifting from job to job and just trying things. And I've always been a bit of a lunatic, really. If I've seen something I'd quite like to do, I would go for it, no matter how ridiculous.
What kind of things are you talking about?
One of my favourites was I managed to blag my way as a professional diver. Yeah, so the idea was I was going to train to be a deep sea diver, mixed gas diver, and I couldn't swim, which was a bad start, but I was working in a place in...
I've just got to check in, this is true, you're not putting me
out. Yeah, this is true, and this is typical me, really, and I was working in a bar in Dubai, and all these divers were coming in on Hollywood wages, and I went, I'd love to do that, but I can't swim, and they said, if you really want to do it, we'll teach you. And they taught me to scuba in a swimming pool. And then I went and had an interview with an American guy at a big American company called Oceaneering in Dubai. I had a forged log book. That said, I was a scuba instructor in the UK for several years.
This is the most dangerous. I think this is like, this is the most dangerous thing anyone's ever described doing. And never, then, to the listener, never forge your logbook and pretend to be a diver.
It's absolutely stupid. And the guys were lovely. And I turned up on day one, and it was what we had to do. I had to look the part. The site boss said, you know, he'll have his eyes on you. The big boss, so just look confident. And I had to, there was two on the side and one in the water, and we were replacing bolts in the dry dock gates, so one side would be dry and have scaffolding, and the other side was the seaside. And the diver would get in seaside, and he would hammer out the bolts of the, or drill out the bolts of the dry dock gates. And then on the other side, there'd be a guy waiting for a bolt to peer through, and it just put a nut on the end. It was really weird.
Okay.
So I was waiting for my turn to go in this, like, Kirby tent it was called, the headset. And he told me I had to jump in. I'm scared of heights as well. And it was about a 20-foot drop into the water.
Oh.
So he said, you've got... I thought he was kidding at first. I thought he knew I was scared of heights. And he wasn't. He said, I said, you are kidding. He went, no. And he said, that you've got to just you jump in. And it seemed like an age. And I jumped in. And it felt like free fall, to be honest. And then the water was all dark and black and... It's pretty scary. Down, I forgot my gloves, so my hands got ripped to bits, and yeah. So that was my. I didn't do it in the end. I came back home with the intentions of going back and seeing it through, and I met a guy that I'd known for years who was a professional diver, and I taught him to play the guitar, and I told him about this opportunity, and he was thrilled to bits for me. And I asked him how his guitar playing was going as I got sorted, and he lifted his hands up, and he'd lost. Both thumbs and a finger about 18 months before in a diving accident. And I just thought, that's probably a sign.
You've probably had a lucky escape there. I can't imagine there are men. I mean, I hate to think there are people out there who've blagged their way into a dive. I mean, it's so dangerous, even if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, foolhardy, isn't it? Yeah, I'm a fool, but I'm not an idiot.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So this is Andy. What an absolute treat to speak to him. What an incredibly humble man. And you must check him out live. And you will see that his humility is, I'm not going to say it's a facade, but it's all the more, what am I trying to say? His humility is all the more beautiful, given his immense comic talent and just how hard he can smash a room to bits. We recorded this before a live gig at the Rose Theatre in Kingston for the Comedy Store. Thank you, Hannah at the Rose, for helping me sort the space out there. And he went on to absolutely demolish the gig, as everyone knew that he would if we knew his stuff. So more coming from Andy in just a second. So much to tell you. I'll try and keep it brief. First things first, the mail out went out. One of my, I think the subject line of the mail out was every 5 to 13 months, like clockwork. Already, as soon as my latest mail out went out, packed with loads of stuff and clips and photos and links and information about the tour and all sorts of stuff on that. Immediately, people... Well, the first thing that happened was someone commented on the Facebook page. No, someone. I think someone replied to me, replied to the mail out saying, oh my God, not another one. God, you're bombarding me. I'm getting out of here. Which was a fine example of the calibre of listener I attract being deeply sarcastic. And the second thing that happened was that people on the Facebook ComCom group started going, hey, what's this mail out? What's this mail out all about? Do I not mention it enough? This is the mail out list that you're on if you subscribe to it to get extra material from the podcast, special bits and bobs. I'm also going to start making older episodes available exclusively to the mailing list. So those are gradually coming off iTunes, older episodes, and I'm saying this now, I haven't got around to it yet, but I'm planning to. So make sure you're on the mail out if you want to find out all sorts of information about the oncoming tour. And that's a very Doctor Who way of describing what I'm up to next. Make sure you're on that. But also, as I said at the very top of the show, make sure that you're subscribed to this podcast, which is a different thing to being a mailing list subscriber. So there's two ways you can do both of those things. The first, you go to comedianscomedian.com and you scroll to very near the bottom of the page, put in your details and join the mailing list. I will then do, probably if I get another 100 people or so do that over the next month, I'll just resend the one that I've sent out. So if you're feeling left out, join the mailing list now. You can get, I'll resend it at the end of the year. Not to everyone else, don't panic. I don't want to interrupt the 5 to 13 month schedule. And if you want to subscribe to the show, then make sure that you click subscribe on iTunes or wherever else, whatever else program you're using to get your podcasts, because there's a little treat coming your way during December. I'm really looking forward to that. It's a little crazy idea I've had. Make sure you are subscribed. Thank you to everyone that was there on the Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, Fukuoka and Osaka tour, the Southeast Asian tour. It was genuinely incredible. I'm going to say an incredibly quick thank you to Nick in Hong Kong and also Stu and all the other podcast fans that turned up, to Scott Mitchell and Jackie Ung, who I gigged with in Singapore. Scott runs a wonderful gig out there, and Jackie Young was just sensational. He's the only person I know who's ever told a knock-knock joke in Cat on stage. Thanks to everyone in the Tokyo stand-up community. Thanks to Paul for your wonderful venue, Ben for helping organise the show, Vinay, Aziz, Peter, all of the people, Anna, all the people out there who are doing stand-up to an excellent degree. For Corker, Stephen and Dwyn, pod fans that turned up to the show, and lovely Shoko that helped show us around. Osaka, Eddie and Tom for their fabulous gig at ROR Comedy, and Mr. Ben and Michael Schaefer, and Momo, a fabulous talent coming out of Osaka, and Ollie Horn for making the whole thing possible. Thank you, Ollie. I've got a lot of respect for clowns, as you know. Every place I went, I could not believe this, every place I went, I had at least 5 or 6 podcast fans show up, and I cannot tell you what it felt like. Sometimes more than that, but I can't tell you how it felt to be in Osaka, which isn't the most famous place in Japan. Pretty great city. The castle's amazing. But to be standing outside the gig and have an apparent stranger walk up to me and go, "Oh my God, it's Richard Herring," like deliberately as a joke, which every time I've relayed that to someone, they're gone, "He thought you're Richard Herring." I'm like, no, it was the caliber of sarcastic fan that I have saying, "Oh my God, it's Richard Herring." That was Noel. Thank you, Noel, for coming along to the show. I genuinely felt cherished by the Comedians Comedian podcast community, the ComCom PodCom. Let's not start calling anyone that. That was a joke. But honestly, to be somewhere on the other side of the world, jet lagged, run ragged, worked like a dog, Ollie, and to turn up at the gigs and know that there were people there getting the in-jokes, coming up to me afterwards, putting strange and wonderful currency in my hand and saying cool things. I cannot tell you how that felt. I was so, so grateful. So thank you, everyone, for being part of that. And talking of coming out and seeing me live, hey, what a link. There's a lot of live stuff coming up, so get on that mail out if you can. Join the Comedians Comedian Facebook group and you can keep abreast with all of this, not to mention suggesting questions for such diverse things as the first of the new season of Live Soho Podcasts is now announced. It's, as you know, I did John Robbins earlier this year. I'm doing Ellis James in but a few weeks. And on the 23rd of January at the Soho Theatre in London, I am doing John and Ellis live. So John Robbins and Ellis James have their own wonderful podcast, which they podcast of their... There's not enough words for podcast. It's like they have a podcast, which is itself them podcasting their Radio X show. So I'm sorry for using the word podcast so often, but that's what it is. It's not enough vocabulary available. So you can find their show and get stuck into it and become a oneer and get drawn into a deeply complex world of keeping it session and being on email and all the other catchphrases that come with the show. If you're a fan of that already, as I'm sure many of you are, come and see them as they both submit to the joint ComCom experience together on 23rd of January at 7:30 at the Soho Theatre. So go to sohotheatre.com to find out about that. The link this year for all of your tour tickets as well is the word Vera. So you remember we used to have a faff code. The code this time is Vera, V-E-R-A, for reasons that will be obvious if you're familiar with my oeuvre. So I'm fairly sure that will work on the Soho site as well. So that I'll make a mental note now to ensure that that works, because I believe those tickets have gone up for sale. So the code is Vera at sohotheatre.com, and the code is Vera on almost all of the ticket sites for my oncoming tour. The oncoming tour, I'm sticking with that. That's either cool if you know your geeky stuff or meaningless if you don't. comedianscomedian.com/tour for all your information. I think one of the venues that isn't doing a Vera code, someone emailed me and said, oh, there's no code on Leicester. That's because Leicester is already Pay What You Want. I'm doing it with Bob Slayer's Heroes of Fringe at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival. Bob and Dave and Stu involved. But that's already Pay What You Want, so I'm not offering a discount on a Pay What You Want ticket. Many apologies. Very rude of me. So comedianscomedian.com/tour for all of the information that you need about the oncoming tour. And almost all of those venues, there is some method on the venue to get either a discount ticket, or there's a limited number of discount tickets. But in all circumstances, the code is Vera, V-E-R-A. An email from, who did I get this from? Oh, this was a donor, Simon Atkinson, who said, what better reminder to donate than to see Stu's storming set in Singapore's most glamorous upstairs room at a pub? I mean, I'm retreading ground here. I should have said that earlier on when I was talking about the Singapore dates. But, I mean, it was great, man. It was great. People came out. I was great. The shows were great. Everything was great. What's that line from Team America? Everything is bon. What an opportunity. And I'm really pleased now that I know what the equation is. And I'll tell you about the equation in the waffle at the end. Now that we know what the equation is, it's just so good to just do the equation. You don't need to have seen me. If you fancy donating, why not take a leaf out of Ed's book? A donor called Ed, who recently said, good day, Stu. Your show has been a real... good day. That's a very Dickensian way of greeting me. Good day to you, Ed. Your show has been a real motivator for me to get on stage. That's always nice to hear. He says, and this is beautifully put. He says, I've done 3 open mics. 2 of them I killed and the 3rd I got murdered. Ed, welcome to the force, son. Thank you. If you're someone who is finding the show motivating, if you're enjoying the content, if you're getting something out of the interviews, then you can, of course, donate. Why not go to comedianscomedian.com/donate? You can sign up for a recurring monthly amount of, for example, £2, or a one-off donation of, for example, £20, or whatever you think the show is worth to you. And remember, if you can't donate at all, that's absolutely fine. The people who can pay for the people who can't. So that is everything I need to tell you at this stage. I mean, just between you and me, Redacted is happening on the 15th of December at the Experimental Late Show time of 10:30 p.m. at the Bill Murray, which is the new name of the new Angel Comedy Club. You can find out all about that by going to the Comedians Comedian Facebook group or my own Facebook fan page, Stuart Goldsmith Comedy, or just going to the Bill Murray pub at 10:30 p.m. Redacted, 3 guests, no recording, top secret, no other advertising. Come along and see that. Should be fun. So now, back to Andy Askins.
So we've established you're the sort of person who's up for doing crazy shit, basically.
Yeah, and why I did comedy, was that the question? Why I got into comedy? Well, yeah, so I worked with my wife for years and years, and then I started playing solo music in pubs and things, which I really, really enjoyed. And I was looking for something more. I had 3 children to look after and a mortgage and a wife. So I was looking for something in addition. So there were 3 things I had going at the same time: photography, hairdressing, and comedy. And I was going at all 3. And
okay.
The comedy worked better.
Did that come out of talking in between playing music? Music gigs, or was it a completely separate thing?
It was something I had thought about doing. I was quite good with hecklers, and when I was in Dubai, it was a very heckler-heavy environment. And years later, I was watching the TV, and it was the BBC New Comedy Awards, and it said, do you think you could do this? Write 10 minutes and send it in. And I thought, well, why not have a go? So I went down the local comedy club, wrote a 10-minute set, and it went really well. And I remember Julie in the car on the way pleading with me not to do it. She was going, please, please, you'll embarrass yourself. It'll be awful.
Oh.
And I got on stage with my little knees wobbling, and people loved it from the outset. And I think if it had gone badly, I probably wouldn't have done it again.
Yeah.
But it went really well. Yeah.
So you wrote 10 minutes from scratch, from nothing. You just wrote 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was about? Do you remember any of that material?
You'll see 10 of it tonight. Yeah. I can't remember. Some of it was about James Bond and villains and stuff. And I don't think there was a lot about Julie and my wife. I remember I was on with Mitch Benn. I think that might have been the first time. And he had his guitar. And I told him I played guitar and played a bit for him. And he said, you really should be using it. It's a skill you should be using rather than... And,
oh, so that first gig, you didn't have the guitar?
No,
okay,
no,
I just envisaged you with it, of course, right.
No, not for the first few gigs. And then I thought, well, maybe I could write something or perform something. And it's something I've always had around my neck, a guitar, and I do feel very comfortable wearing it. It's my little shield.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
And that was it, really. That was it. It went well for a lot of little open spots, and it took me a long time. It probably took me about 5.5 years from my open spot to going full time. But it was very difficult finding anywhere that would let me play. And it cost me about £150 a time as well to go and do an open spot. So,
in terms of travel?
Yeah, I'd have to cancel a gig.
I see what you mean. Music, a paid gig elsewhere.
And then I'd have to get the ferry across and drive it. So was it?
Because you're Isle of Wight.
Yeah, so it'd be 150, 160 quid, you know, to go somewhere and try out 10 minutes. So it was.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was expensive. Yeah.
Did you consider moving? Or was that just not on the cards?
I never thought about it because Julie and my children were so happy, and it was ideal where we were living for schools, for everything, the environment, the beach. It's just wonderful. And funny enough, we are moving now. Yeah.
Oh, are you? Where are you moving?
Probably the Reading area.
Okay.
Yeah. My wife's sort of like turf. And the kids are older now, so there's not a lot on the island for kids once to leave school, really.
Sure. Yeah. So in terms of that, going back to that 10 minutes that you wrote, or writing in general, are you a sit-down and write person? Are you a make it up on stage and then gradually it turns into material? What's your approach?
Yeah, a bit of everything. A lot of my little jokes will just come out of conversations and I won't even recognise them. I won't even. In fact, I do a gag. I've been doing it for a long time, and I had a rubber band on. It was a band that my daughter gave me from the swimming baths. She got it and forgot to hand it back. A little yellow rubber band, and on the back she'd wrote "Number One Dad," and she gave it to me. And I was with Greg Davis in the dressing room, and I showed him. He went, "Oh, that's lovely, Number One Dad." I went, "Yes, I wrote that." And really laughed. And he said, "You should put that in your set." And I did, and it's been in ever since.
So which bits of material of yours do you regard as, like, which are you most proud of? Is there a particular line or a particular section?
No, I'm the Ku Klux Klan gag I'm proud of that. And not really because I think it's particularly this, that, or the other. It's just so many people have said they really like the joke. I remember trying it out, that gag. I was in Afghanistan, funny enough, with a group of comics, and I just said, "Do you think this is funny?" And I think four of them says, "Nah." And Jim Jeffries went, "That is gold." And I tried it out.
I know the line, but do you mind butchering it just to tell us the line?
Yeah, I'll certainly butcher it. And it's, I don't think I'm racist, but the Ku Klux Klan, they all look the same to me. And
I'm sorry, that is a joke that I use to describe you to people.
Oh,
I'm
like, okay.
Oh, you know, and you know, in the way that you'll go, oh, he's lovely, he's got this lovely... So, you know, if you describe another comic, you go, here's an example of one of his jokes.
Yeah.
Like that. It's, I mean, it's just a golden joke.
Yeah, but again, that's a joke I probably wouldn't have done, given that four comics I really liked said it wasn't very good. It's only Jim, really, just went, oh, that's great.
I tell you what I love about that joke. It's the performance of it, or more than the content.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I can, or certainly like over the years of telling other people about it, I've done it in like my version of your yeah. accent and your persona. And I think the way it reads in my head is that Punchline goes, the Ku Klux Klan, they all look the same to us. And it's the fact that you're so small and vulnerable, and it's like you're genuinely trying not to offend the Ku Klux Klan. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're so, what's funny about it to me is you're so nice.
Oh, bless you.
And that's, I think that position is fascinating. So there, a listener asked a question that I wanted to pass on to you. A listener called, it's Ben, a comedian, Ben Vanderveld, who you might know.
Oh, okay.
Ben said, how do you manage to control rowdy audiences with such gentleness? Because that's something you're really known for, is you can win with such softness and quietness.
I wasn't really aware of that. I just think if an audience thinks you're funny, they might pay attention, and I just hope they'll give me 1 or 2 minutes to let me say a few gags, and hopefully they'll like the gags, and then they'll listen some more, and that's it really. There's nothing other than that. It's and regarding when it gets rowdy, it's a bit difficult for me. I can certainly handle it, and I have done on several occasions. But in order to do that, you have to come out with sort of like the persona, low status, because putting people down is quite high status, really. So it ruins the illusion, really. I don't like dealing with heck. I don't like being not nasty to people, but I don't like putting people down particularly. Yeah, so
do you have a go-to approach that works for you in terms of like a line you'll say to do?
I have got some lines, and I found they're far more powerful than I want. It's like using a hand grenade when a fly spray would do. And
yeah.
So I really try not to use any lines I've prepared, and I've prepared hundreds of them over the years, and fortunately I very rarely had to do any put downs.
I think I've got maybe four original kind of put downs, and
yeah.
two of them I'm so like, they've saved my life so many times.
Okay.
They've turned a gig from being an absolutely fine gig.
Yes.
Someone attacks. If you get one of those out, woof, suddenly everyone is just right back into it. But the issue I find is that, and I say that
yes.
number is like a pathetically low number.
Yeah.
I normally try and get passed on. I normally
yes.
get by on charisma. If someone
yeah.
attacks, I try
yeah.
and, you know, try and explore it and give them enough rope to hang themselves, sort of thing.
Yes.
More than I kind of shoot back a killer line.
That's a clever way. And I love watching that. I do. Love the art of dealing with audience members in a nice way, in a gentle way, in a funny way. And there's a lot of people do it so well, and
yeah.
in a disarming way. But each to their own. And some audiences love nothing more than seeing, especially if it's an idiot in the audience, being torn to shreds.
Yeah,
I mean that's a real gig, a winner, that isn't it? But me personally, I'm very lucky, and most of the time I'm left alone. And if I'm not left alone, I try and come up with something particular for that person, and it's normally something quite gentle, and I get on with my stuff.
There is the gentleness, I think, is definitely part of it. An oft-quoted line on this show, something I mentioned all the time, is that lovely... You said Harry Hill before, his line about, his heckler line of going, you can say what you like about me, sir, but I know when I get home, I've got a lovely chicken in the oven. Because it's so perfect for him, because
yes.
it allows him to be disarming, because it
yes.
would be quite out of character for him to slam someone.
Yes.
In a similar way that I think it would be for you.
Yeah.
Do you have like a similar, or, you know, is there something similar in that kind of angle of approach for you?
Again, that's just a thing of some kind of gentle taught or a mark. Harry Hill is a wonderful exponent, isn't he, of the art of comedy. Sounds like a military combat, doesn't it? I just I crack on with it. It's not something I really have a lot of problems with. Yeah.
So when you said you kind of prepared various lines over the years, you sort of sat down writing them. Are you sitting writing on a notebook or in a laptop? What's your...
Well, I used to spend a lot of time. I was that typical comic where I would wake up in the middle of the night and write stuff. And my poor wife, non-stop, endless. Is this funny? 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 And I've done that thing. I've just sat at the desk for 2 or 3 hours, just writing out and putting words. But most of my stuff, I'll just be talking to somebody and I'll say something and something good will come out. I remember probably one of my favourite bits of material to do is that the thing about getting into a fight with a mime act. And it was just, I don't know where it came from. I was talking to Mick Ferry, who I absolutely adore. Mm. And he said to somebody, did you see that film with all the mime acts fighting? And something clicked, and about 5 minutes later, I went and did that routine on stage. Pretty much word for word as I do it now. It came out. It must have been some kind of godlike experience inside me. It wasn't me. It was just divine inspiration, I'm sure.
So do you have a particular way of, like if you make a note of something, do you have like a way of trying to find the funniest way to do an idea? Like how do you edit as you go along? If you're mostly using stuff that's occurred to you, what are your kind of processes for refining it?
In that respect, if I get something, I tend to use it as it is. And there's very few times when I'll go over and over and change, and it just seems to work 90% of the time. There have been times when I've got a story which I knew was funny, but just couldn't get there to the end. And sometimes it takes me years, and it'll go, hold on, that's how that needs to end. So I do get that a lot. I'm one of these comics, I don't know if you're the same, I've got dozens of notebooks all filled with ideas and jokes, and my biggest failure is I never look through any of them. I just write and I never read back.
Yeah.
So now and again, I will every 6 months look back through and see some 90% of it is crap, and it'll be one line and it'll make me laugh really loud. And it'll be, I saw something yesterday on a slip of paper and it really made me laugh. And so I'll try and work that in somewhere.
Can you tell us what that is, just for the purposes of analysis?
Well, it might be awful. I've got a couple of lines that I've always thought were really funny that never ever worked. But no, I won't spoil it.
Go on. Sorry, you interrupted you.
But one line I loved performing, and it never got a laugh, and it was it got a laugh once from Ian Stone from behind the curtain.
I love those laughs. Another comic backstage laughing. I love that.
It was just Ian really, really laughing, and a whole audience just nothing at all.
What was that line?
It was quite a niche joke, and the joke was, I don't know if you've got any cabaret singers in here this evening, but if you have, I'd like to do a joke for you now. And it goes something like this. Nothing.
Because they were all taking it at face value and expecting a joke.
Yeah, perhaps. Or again, it's just a little Mickey take out of cabaret singers, isn't it?
I absolutely should incorporate this question into future interviews, because I love that idea of like all comics have got stuff that they can't make work.
Yeah,
I love it, like an idea that you're dancing around. Yeah. You're like, I've been thinking of this for 10 years and I can't make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've still got my opening gag, actually, that was on a table for probably 5 or 6 years, about me getting embarrassed playing badminton. And
Remind me of the bit. I can't remember that bit.
Oh, it's quite rude and explicit, but it's basically getting an erection while playing badminton, and it's been the most awkward situation, and it's actually a true story. Yes.
So pleased to hear that.
Yes. And I thought, this is really funny, but how do I make it funny? Because it's inherently funny, the situation, but getting it into some kind of format.
So what kind of versions did you try?
No, I didn't try any. I just looked and went, no, that's no good. That won't work. I was just trying to come. And then just one day, and it was just a silly thing about the way water goes around plug holes. That's all it was. It was just weird.
And it's really funny because your body language right now suggests that you are embarrassed about the idea of the explicitness of it.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Because you're
yeah.
in offstage mode.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think that's really fascinating, the difference between the real you and the performative you. Mm. I'm just want to come back to this idea you mentioned before of part, some of it is stuff that you wish you could say if you were different.
Yeah, yeah, perhaps. It's the sort of thing I hear people say, and I really laugh, and I just think, oh, I'd never be brave enough to say that. Partly sometimes it's because it's just a wrong thing to say, or just bad human behaviour or whatever, and it just makes me laugh. And so
I remember seeing you at Bestival.
Oh,
the festival there. Oh man, did you enjoy that?
If this is all about truth,
go on.
I don't enjoy festivals. I feel I feel like an outsider, really. And I do. The festival is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And Brett Vincent, I absolutely adore. And he's asked me for years, over the years, to do every year, and I have done for free tickets for my kids.
Yeah, put yourself through it. You're a hero.
but my time on stage at Bestival is I find it apparently it goes down really well, but inside I'm dying. It's especially on the Isle of Wight, you know, because again it's people that might know me and come and see. It's that thing about performing in front of people that know you. Never shit on your own doorstep.
That must be difficult for the sort of act that you're describing, the sort of relationship to the, you know, not to the truth, but like the things you say, like saying wicked things on stage. Mm. Yeah, if someone knows you, like, do you worry what? That they might think that's the real you?
Oh, yeah, perhaps. I remember doing a gig, actually my first sort of bona fide gig on the Isle of Wight. And I'd put it off for years and years and years. And then eventually I thought, oh yeah, somebody had pulled out at the last minute. It was the Key Arts Centre. And I got a phone call. Could you do this? Actually, if I remember rightly, I'd asked if I could do an open spot to try some material out.
Okay.
And they said, would you do the gig instead? And you can try out new stuff. And I said, oh, not really. Anyway, I was persuaded and I did it. And of course, I didn't try out new stuff because I just wanted to do the best I could. And I thought nothing of it until a week before. And it never occurred to me that it would be advertised in the local newspaper and promoted. And so all of a sudden, just doing this little gig on the Isle of Wight, I'm getting phone calls and texts. I didn't know you were a comedian.
Oh, no. And you don't tell your mates that you're a comedian?
No, not for years. People didn't know. Not for years. And the school teachers were there, my kids' school teachers. And yeah. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, they're going to think, what an awful man. You know, when they see me perform. But I do what I do, and I want to...
How did the gig go?
Really good. It was a really good gig, and everyone was, very happy, and, it was a really good gig.
And presumably no one got in touch to say, you're an awful man. Like,
they didn't.
Get it, right?
No, you just got all these fears, haven't you? And everyone was lovely, and next thing you know, I haven't had any negativity towards... my comedy or making people laugh, not that I'm aware of. I think everybody seems to be okay with it, especially my kids' friends, which are the most important.
Oh, right.
Not being your dad's a shit comic is very important to me. And luckily, my kids' friends seem to think it's funny. Now they're older.
You remind me a little bit of like a hermit crab. Like you're very happy to be... Like you're probably one of the most socially introverted comics I've met. Do you know what I mean? You're very happy to be quiet. You're very happy in your own space. In a way that's actually, it's quite an attractive quality when you've met as many comedians as we all have. You're like, I'm blessed. Like if I was, you know, you're one of those names, I'm sure that if people go, oh, can you give Andy Askins a lift? People go like, oh yeah, fine. Do you know what I mean? That isn't going to be a hellish self-involved, you know, car journey.
And then he danced across the forecourt.
All the way across the forecourt. So we left him. Do you believe in yourself as a comic? Do you have self-confidence? Do you have self-belief?
Not particularly. I'm not a person that sort of like arrives at a place and goes, this is going to be great, wait till I get a load of me. Not at all. I've never been like that. Every gig I always think, I'm much better now just because I had some really good advice from, I'll tell you what, it was Tom Stade, who was, he's like a, there's a couple of guys on the circuit that are more like life coaches speak to them. And Tom's one of those guys. And I remember him saying to me, I was particularly nervous about a gig. And Tom said, how many gigs have you done? I said, oh, you know, probably 1,000, 2,000, I've no idea, thousands. And he went, how many were bad? And I went, oh, probably not that many, a dozen, I don't know, a couple, not many. And he said, well, what makes you think that this gig is going to go any different? And I thought, just reframe it. And, I've never been, particularly confident. Not about this. In some aspects, I'm confident, but not on stage in comedy and that kind of thing, yeah.
Because there's a certain way, isn't there, in which the comedy industry rewards those who stand up and shout about themselves?
I don't know about that. I think there's a lot to... It's a business, isn't it, comedy? And you people that can market themselves, that's going to be an advantage. And I suppose confidence is something that people want to see, isn't it? If you want somebody to go in front of a TV show for you, you don't want somebody in a dressing room having a panic attack. You want somebody who thinks they're a god.
yeah, absolutely. So I think that's the point I was trying to make, which is that...
Yeah, sorry.
You know, I think comedy rewards those who have that kind of self-confidence and they put themselves forward for things.
Yeah.
They, you know, in a way that may, like, do you think your career would be different if you were a bit more, like, you know what I mean? If you didn't need your wife to bully you into potential opportunities for self-promotion. It's a difficult question to ask because I'm not suggesting that your career is in any way. Do you know what I mean? I think you're an excellent comic. You're clearly doing very well.
I feel I've probably overachieved. Really, I've really enjoyed what I've got out of comedy and the experiences I've had. Definitely, I've always thought of that side of it as something perhaps like a moth to a flame. Really, I think I'm very happy with my life. And I'm not sure if I could cope with all that kind of stuff, to be honest with you. I think I have seen people doing really well and their lives really change. You see people, sometimes in a good way, but I've seen some people that are really, really famous and they get stopped every 2 minutes for just a kind word or a chat or an autograph. And I think that to me, that would be living hell. And those guys that earn the big bucks and the fame and that, I mean, some people handle it better than others and stuff, but I'm very happy being the grey man. I really am, yeah.
That's an unusual set of parameters for what constitutes success is I need to be able to enjoy myself and feed my family without getting so successful that I have to speak to people.
It's quite sad, isn't it?
Not at all. God, I mean, it's the amount of comics who I've interviewed, we're nearing 200 comics have been on this show.
Oh, wow.
And so few of them have been able to sit there and say, well, the thing is, I'm really happy. Do you know what I mean? You are winning.
Yeah, that's the way I think of it anyway. You know, at the moment I'm winning, so yeah, I'm happy. There might be a time when I'm on my deathbed thinking, you fool. But it's not as if I've got the tools to do it any other way. I am who I am, and you know, so that's it.
Have you always been happy? Are you happy? Is it that you've had good things happen in your life, or do you have a base level of?
Yeah, I've always tried to be happy, and and look for the best in people really whenever I could, and I've always tried to make other people happy.
Is there a secret to being happy?
I think realising how lucky you are, I think putting things into perspective, you know. It's a tough old world, isn't it? And just being... I read that Bill Bryson book, only the first chapter, because it's the sort of person I am. And it was about that we're all just carbon and we'll die and we'll just be dust and we'll go and make something else. And I think, you know, so try and be happy. You're only here a short time and you can either make people happy and try and be happy yourself, or you can go around trying to mess people about and be horrible. And I know which I prefer.
That's lovely. It's really lovely to hear.
I noticed one of the things on your website was the armed forces gigs.
Yeah.
Does that require a certain different approach to regular gigs, or do you just play them exactly as you would play here tonight?
Pretty much. Of course, the materials, you write material specific to that kind of environment because it's it.
Got any couples in?
Yeah, exactly. No, basically, they found me. It wasn't the other way around. So it turns out my humour is quite... It's a military... That's how it's described, a military-like humour. And it's the same sort of humour you would find shared in the dressing rooms of a fire station or people that work for the ambulance or nurses. It's a dark humour that enables people to cope, it seems, with bad situations. And it seems that's the humour I've got. And it works really well in that environment. And it was something they asked me to try. And to be honest, when I was first asked to do a military gig, there were lots of people being asked. And most of them, 95%, didn't want to do it. And the only reason, truthfully, I did it was I'd just been taken on by management. And they set me up with the opportunity. And I thought, you will look like an idiot if you don't even try this, and even though it looks quite, might be quite tough, and so I tried it, and it was absolutely wonderful, and I really found a place I could be comfortable, and people I could be comfortable with. I loved the military, and still do. Yeah.
Were you one of the people who got awarded a, like, was there sort of a medal or something?
Yeah, I was very lucky. Yeah, it was a bit embarrassing, but yeah, we did a lot of gigs out there, and basically if you do a certain number of days in a hostile environment, you're eligible for a medal. And it doesn't matter whether you're a clerk or whether you're a paratrooper or a civilian working in the NAFI. If you're in that environment, you're eligible for a medal. Now, most of the guys are at the cutting edge and at the pointy bit, and we were doing gigs, and we were doing gigs in some quite hostile areas, so we did see some horrible things and have some quite scary experiences. And at the end of it all, I got a phone call, never even thought about it, saying, "Oh, you've qualified for a certain number of days, and we'd like to present you with a medal." And it's a bit weird, but then when I spoke to the people that were in charge, they said, "Oh, no, it's a really big deal." And I thought it'd be very disrespectful, actually, for me to say, "Oh, I don't think I should have this medal." And so, I went along at a lovely ceremony with my wife, and it was really good, and it was a huge honour because they actually gave us a campaign medal, which is because there's a civilian medal and there's a military medal, and I don't know if we were the first people to be given the military medal that was civilians. I'm not sure. But that was because of the places we were doing gigs, which was a huge honour. And
that's amazing. Yeah. When you talk about the sort of hostile environment, and you know, I don't want to sort of pry into horrible things that you see.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether an environment in which your life might be endangered. I wonder which Andy is sort of at the forefront there, because part of me thinks, well, you're a family man. You love your family. You want to be home with your family. And then part of me sort of also now thinking, you blagged being a scuba diver. Do you know what I mean? Is that is there a sense that it's exciting for you?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I never really, when I was asked to go to some of the sharp bits, I couldn't wait. Honestly, I couldn't.
Really?
Yeah, but my
what sort of can you say what sort of places?
Basically, there were forward. Iraq was pretty hairy.
Can you define pretty hairy?
Yeah, I never really felt in that much danger in all the times out there, but we were in danger. I remember once we got stopped on a road move, and it was the one and only time we did a road move. And the military do this stuff all day, every day. You know, and we did it just the once. And on the way to the gig, we had a tank in front and all this, that and the other. And we had to stop, and we stopped. And I didn't know why, but they made a perimeter around us. We were in open ground. And I thought, oh, something's going to kick off here, and perhaps we're going to get attacked from, I don't know. And there was just something wrong with a certain piece of kit on the vehicle, and it was dangerous to move forward without that bit of kit working. So they fixed it. We went on our way, and then we arrived at the destination, and we found out later on that day that an IED had gone off the road we'd gone over, and it was probably the bit of kit that they'd fixed had stopped it from going off, and it exploded later on in the day between two vehicles, so nobody was killed. But I thought, oh God, that's, you know, that was close. You didn't even know, you know. And yeah, there's some shooty bits as well. And yeah.
Shooty bits,
yeah. Yeah, and it's nothing, honestly, nothing really. You're not charging the enemy or anything like that, or running from cover to cover.
Were you shot at? Or vehicles you were in shot at?
Yeah, there was, again, it didn't seem that dangerous. You just told to do stuff and you do it. But one time, apparently, I'm not sure, our aircraft was under attack, the airfield, a mortar attack. And so our aircraft comes shuddering to a halt halfway along the runway. We all had to run off and, yeah, things like that. And lying down, waiting for rockets to land. They're indiscriminate, so you don't know where they're going to land. So you just laid there, you know, looking at each other going...
I mean, just for the benefit of the listener, there was an actual smile on your face there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not brave. I'm just stupid. But I never felt in any particular danger. And I heard some horrific stories, and I met some people that had been through some really dreadful experiences. You know, absolutely shocking. And I'll never forget the age of these guys as well, especially in the beginning of the campaign, how young they were and how brave they were. And they were doing things you shouldn't expect anybody to do, really. And they were doing it with a smile on their face and saying things like, I couldn't do what you do. Yeah. And they were running in caves with grenades and running in caves to take on enemies and stuff, like 19-year-old paratroopers. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And so it's very humbling and sobering.
And yet what we were talking about was you're attracted to that kind of...
I did like it. And there's no doubt about it. I really enjoyed every moment of it, the people I met. And yeah, I do like a bit of all that kind of macho stuff now and again. Yeah, I think it's sleeping out. And yeah, I do like that kind of thing, yeah.
Sleeping out?
Yeah, like overnight stays around friends' houses and stuff. Yeah, no. Yeah, I do like that military environment. It's very good. Yeah, it's good.
So I'm sort of amazed that you've never been recruited for MI5, given the kind of grey man ability to disappear in a crowd.
Yeah, it's not something I'd really want to comment on.
Yeah. Now, knowing you, the little that I do, I'm really happy to let that sit there, because we'd all love to believe that were the case, and I'm very happy if you're not to comment.
As long as it's not high.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that might put you out of something. Did you do Edinburgh this year?
I did, yeah.
Was that your first time?
It was, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, it was really good. It was something people have always said, oh, you must do Edinburgh. You try it at least once. And it's something I'd never particularly wanted to do. I didn't think I was the sort of comic that would do well up there or enjoy it. And it's a very expensive thing to do as well.
I just want to stop you there and look at that thing. You didn't think you were the sort of comic who would do well up there. What preconception is that exactly? What sort of comic do you think does well up there?
When I first started doing comedy, I didn't really know anybody or know anything about the circuit or anything. And I did feel a bit uncomfortable, like an outsider, really, that I'd come to the game really late. And wasn't sure how people viewed me or my humour. You know, so there's a little bit of snobbery about here and there. Not a lot of it. And, you know, I listen to that kind of thing and just think, oh, do you know what? I'm quite happy not doing all that stuff. And especially when the kids were younger, it's so expensive. The attraction of going to Edinburgh and or taking the kids on a nice holiday, there was always going to be one winner. I mean, there's lots of work around in August. So, but the kids are older now, and I'm older, and I've done some really nice things in the last couple of years. I thought, right, try Edinburgh. Why not? What? And I took my family, which was amazing. All my kids went, my wife went, we took the dog. And it was as lovely an experience as I think I could have had, yeah.
And where, what room were you in? What time were you? What was the sort of infrastructure of it?
I was in the counting house in the ballroom, which is
So the Gilded Balloon.
Yes.
So free entry, or they can book for a fiver, is that right?
Yeah, that was right. And it was a big room for me. I had no idea. So naive. I didn't ask enough. I asked plenty of questions, but again, I had no idea what Edinburgh was about. And it was a big room. And yeah, I did all right. I probably averaged about 30 people a night, and then the weekends, maybe it's 100, 110, 20, something. So,
had you written a show specifically for Edinburgh, or was it best of?
It was best of. Whenever I spoke to people, and I've been pondering it for years, it's all, should I? One year I really wanted to do it, and I couldn't get a room. And this year was touch and go. It was last minute, and I just thought, if I don't do it now, I won't do it next year. I'll never do it. And I wanted to try it once. But people have always said, your first year, do your greatest hits. And I thought, if I'm going to give myself the best opportunity to make people laugh, I've got lots of funny stuff, and see how it goes. And it went well. I really enjoyed it, and the audiences were good. Far lovelier than he imagined. Again, that demon in your head before you go on stage saying, oh, they're not going to enjoy it, or, you know, you're going to get found out or whatever. And it was very much the same in Edinburgh the first few nights. I thought, I can't play to 12 people. I feel ridiculously naked in front of 12 people as opposed to 1,200 or 400. And yeah, it was just ill-conceived nonsense on my part, really. They were absolutely lovely. Yeah.
I think there is a certain slice of the circuit who gigs, you know, headliners, circuit headliners who've been going a good while, who don't buy into the Edinburgh system. And I'm wondering whether that's a similar sort of reasoning. There's someone in particular I've got in mind. I won't say their name, but I'm trying to convince them to go to Edinburgh at the moment. And they're a little bit like, oh, what have I got? I can't do, you know. And there's some sort of, I'm like, you're insane. It's just a gig every day for a month. It's a fun gig.
Yeah, it was good. Like, it, just the experience. I love the whole atmosphere. And there was a real camaraderie about it, which I wasn't sure was going to be there or not. But even down to, like, chatting to the people that were flying every day, it was just, the whole thing was lovely. And the people that were running the venue could have been more accommodating, more lovely. The sound, everything was just nice. It was.
Will you go again?
I'm thinking about it.
And presumably now you've done your best of hour.
Yeah.
If you go again, that's a very different proposition.
Yeah.
Right, slightly different.
Yeah, not ridiculously hard. I mean, that's my greatest hits. And I didn't exactly, I had a good time and everybody laughed. And writing a whole new hour in 6 months or a year, I don't know. It'd have to be something different. I'd have to do something slightly different. And I am thinking about it. I'm thinking of reasons why I should and reasons not to go as well. So it's up in the air at the moment.
Are there people pushing you? Are there, like, either management or Julie? Is there kind of like a... Like, because I noticed you did the John Bishop show fairly recently. Was that this year or last year?
Yeah, I did that last summer. And again, that was just completely out of the blue. It was actually found out about it. I was around a friend's house, and I said, oh, there's a new TV show, because I'd come close to doing the McIntyre show. I was in the shortlist and never quite made it, whatever, and which I would have loved to have done. And then I've never really had much of a sniff at a TV. And then I heard there was going to be a show on, and it was... they would be quite happy to put on comics that were on the circuit that were older. And basically, I auditioned for it. I think everybody auditioned for it. Loads and loads auditioned. And I got the last slot, and it went really well. And I just loved every second of it.
So what was that experience like of, as you say, that having not had a sniff of telly for a long time? Did it feel different to be doing a proper televised big live show?
Well, I was in a little bit of shock, really, because it was a prime time thing and it was a huge production value, and it was out of the blue, and all of a sudden you wonder what it would be like to do a show like that, and all of a sudden it's there and you've got the demons again, and, you know, you think about all the other comics that could have done it, and it was great and I loved it, and I did a couple of things after that, and I really embraced it. I didn't worry about how it was going to go, and I just thought, this is going to be a special moment in your life, and really enjoy it. And John Bishop, the man's a god. He couldn't be if there's a lovelier man that high up, I don't know who he is. He was fabulous. Yeah, so.
And just to wrap up then, because we must, people are beating down the door very gently and quietly. When you mentioned like the demons are there, given how happy you are and how satisfied, how you're kind of like, you're a lovely combination of kind of happy and humble, and you're sort of successful within your own, you know, to your own definition,
yes,
of success.
Yes, yeah.
So what are the demons that you get? What are the, are there any negative moments? Do you have those moments of going, I can't write another joke, I'm run out? You know, do you get blocked? Do you what are the demons for you?
Not really. It's funny. I sort of like live in the moment, and in my life, it's split between traveling and doing stand up and going home. And when I go home, that's all I think about, going home. I'll think about jokes and I'll write jokes, but I'm in my element there. That's where I want to be. And then when I'm on the road, I live in the moment. I don't try to worry about I worry about going on stage and dying on my ass. That's what I worry about, and probably that's all I worry about, whether or not I'll be able to provide for my family. Those two worries, everything else not a problem with anything at all.
And finally then, do you have a plan for stopping ever, or is the plan to gig until you die?
Is
that a difficult question? We can cut this if that's a difficult question to answer.
Not really.
No one wants to go, oh yeah, I'm going to retire. You know, that's fine.
I don't think I would be, if I could retire, I probably would retire. It's not something that I think I've got, I must do this. Not at all. But I really enjoy performing. If I probably will gig until I die. Who knows? It could be tomorrow, couldn't it?
What a lovely man. What a lovely, lovely, what an absolute pleasure to spend some time with Andy. And what an incredible life. And what a happy man. What a happy man. What's the secret of happiness, Andy? Well, apparently it's working hard, doing things you enjoy, taking risks, being grateful, being humble, loving your family. I mean, it's not rocket science, is it? You just be as nice as Andy Askins, and that's how you get happy. So I think we've all learned something from there. And honestly, he's so, so funny. You must... I think sometimes when there's not a huge amount of Andy available online, there's a couple of... I think there's one or two clips of him at the Comedy Store. Get to see him. If you're in London, check the Comedy Store listings and get down there when Andy's on. I think of that... I know it's not where he's from, but I think of that as his home turf. I suppose that's the venue I've seen him most often. He talks so humbly about his ability that you could be forgiven for listening to this and going, oh yeah, well, he seems average. Oh my God, he is just brilliant. And that thing about the amount of material he has that sometimes, not that it's, you know, more than 20%, but the simple fact of having tags that audiences sometimes don't notice, or like the bulk of audiences don't notice, because they're so subtle. And then you're one of the people that notices them and you're just like, this is delightful. I'm sure there'll be a lot of comedians listening to this thinking, yes, absolutely, that's exactly the skill of Andy Askins, is barnstorming set and loads of stuff there that you've got to be listening out for, that just is hundreds of cherries on lots and lots of cakes. Thank you, Andy. And thank you, Andy's missus. Very much appreciated for bullying him onto the show. Sorry about that. I hope it wasn't too painful. That is all. I'll chat to you briefly in a waffly kind of way in a sec. But for now... provided you've got your tickets sorted, you're going to turn up for free at Redacted on the 15th of December, provided you're going to come and see John and Ellis at Soho Theatre on the 23rd of January using the discount code Vera, and indeed using that code to go to comedianscomedian.com/tour and work out where you're going to come and see me in the spring, having listened to all this wonderful praise from the Southeast Asian tour and thought, maybe I'll get round to Goldsmith. If you like, you can leave now. If you want to hang around... I will tell you a couple of things in the waffle, but for now, that concludes the podcast. So, I was wrong about the election, but in my defence, everyone was wrong about the election. If you remember last episode, the Carmen Lynch episode, I pre-recorded before going away to Japan, and I sort of, as did we all, I assumed it was all going to be okay, and now we're in a position where a sort of terrifying...
untrustworthy madman runs America, and madman is not provable and offensive to those with mental health issues, but he's terrifying and untrustworthy. His word is worthless, isn't it? He doesn't mean anything he says, but he does loads of stuff that he means, and he's already started peopling the White House with equally terrifying right-wing and alt-right uber nationalist people, and it's enough to make me wonder whether the world is getting better. I feel like I've had a baby at the wrong time, I'll tell you that much. God, much as I love him, what a terrifying... You'll all be over this now, because it's been a couple of weeks, but I just haven't had the chance to vent about this, and, you know, I always could fall back mentally on the idea that things were gradually getting better. And I've argued with friends about, like, you know, in a sort of global civilization way, I've argued with friends about this. They say that's an incredibly privileged thing to think, because I happen to have a comfortable life. To think that the world is getting better is outrageous, because there are still horrific things happening on, you know, in even at home domestically, there's awful poverty, of course, and food banks and all of this terrible stuff that's happening. Post-austerity, terrible decisions have been made, housing markets collapsing, you know, the environmentally, that's like a global awful thing. Plus you've got people, you know, in Thailand who have effectively slave labor getting, you know, in order to get the nation's prawns. You know what I mean? This is sounding bewildering, and I'm trying to remain aware of the gravitas of the awful things that are happening in the world, whilst also have a sufficiently light tone that this doesn't become all doom and gloom. So apologies to anyone offended by the loose handling of slavery in the prawn industry, but that's a real thing. And, you know, North Korea, the fact of North Korea, that's awful. Look, obviously, there's a lot of awful things in the world. My point is that I would always take the argumentative position that, yes, stuff is terrible, but it's getting better, because 500 years ago, we'd all just be walking around killing each other. Do you know what I mean? Or 1,000 years ago, it would just be the rule of warlords. And not necessarily in London, but do you know what I mean? It's like we are gradually becoming more civilized. And yes, there is a price that we all pay for that. There's a price that the world pays. As the world becomes more civilized, people are exploited. But if you think back to pre-civilization, where it was just club someone over the head and take their stuff, things are better now overall. That was the position I would take. And now I feel like I don't know if I can say that that's the position overall. I think the combination of the apparent swing in the West towards the right, and not just, I don't, you know, I'm not having a go if you voted Tory or if you're American and you voted for Trump, but the very frightening swing towards isolationism and towards protectionism and... I haven't done the reading, but let's face it, neither of you. And it just seems to me that the world is a little bit of a colder place now. And I am terrified to have to imagine the spectre of war. Ultimately, that's what it boils down to. That's what my... I mean, for all that people burble about unelected bureaucrats in Brussels, the whole point of the EU, as far as I could see, was that it stopped us all going to war. It greatly reduced the chances of war breaking out within Europe. We weren't war-proof, and yes, there were international wars rather than domestic ones, and even in some places in the EU. But the point was, let's trade rather than fight, right, guys? You want to be in charge of your country, yes, and your destiny and your country's freedom and self-determination. And yes, you need to give up a little bit of control if you want to work with people rather than just be isolated from them. And I know that upsets a lot of people, the idea of giving up control. But the point is, ultimately, it's not so much hooray for trade, it's trade instead of war. And I feel like we might have a warmonger in the White House, or at least someone who, oh my God, look, it's not all doom and gloom. The point I'm trying to make is I thought the world was getting better, and now I feel like maybe the world isn't getting better. Maybe there is. And, you know, obviously I'm approaching this now. I've got a tiny 9-month-old horse in the race. So I was wrong about that, and we'll move on, but I was wrong. So I, you know, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Well, I don't have a vote in America, certainly. But, I mean, all I can hope, is this wrong? Tell me if this is wrong. All I can hope is that he'll stuff it up so badly that 4 years from now, the Democrats will get back in for 20 years. Is that likely? Maybe that's not so likely. It's just scary. I'm just saying that it's scary. Of course, I haven't got any solutions, but it's pretty scary, isn't it, guys? Holy shit. Let's talk about something nicer. And this is very brief because there's a little squealing boy downstairs I must go and help look after. But in happier times and happier thoughts, let me tell you about the equation that I've worked out, and then let me depress you all again. The equation that I've worked out, and forgive me if I've mentioned this before, this is my job. This is Stew Career Maths. You do the math, or as we say in the UK, you do some maths. What I need to do is continue growing the audience of this podcast and making it interesting for people to listen to. And then I need to continue convincing everyone that listens to the podcast to come and try seeing me live. And then I need to be good enough live that all of those people decide to come and see me again. And that's the plan. That's the equation. And I tell you what, having a mission statement makes such a difference rather than the far more nebulous mission statement of be good at stand-up comedy, which is... which was the sort of mission after there's the initial mission, which is be a comedian. And then there's the secondary mission, or not secondary, but there's the next goal, which is become paid. And then the next one is become paid only for stand up comedy, e.g. become full time. And then it's a little bit like, right, what happens next apart from just more of this? And to have the mission of like become a touring comic and grow and cultivate the audience and have the means by which to do it, that's very satisfying. That's very satisfying. Now, here's the question. To what extent can one be selfish about the pursuit of one's career goals in a world that is going to hell in a handbasket? Because, I mean, has the world always been going to hell in a handbasket? I sort of felt like it usually was, only now we have not only the possible spectre of war, but also the environment to worry about in that kind of a, oh yeah, Trump's going to pull out of Paris, he's going to pull out of all of the agreements that are intended to all of the scientists who said, right, I mean, this is, it's coming up midday on Wednesday, unless we immediately reverse everything we're doing at that point, then it's irrevocable, it's unrepairable. And now we've got someone at the helm who thinks that it's a hoax. And not our helm, but one of the main helms. So, what's the fucking point? Do you know what I mean? Like, you've got all of your little micro plans. Oh, this is great. I'm on top of it. Got a kid. Career seems to have consolidated somehow. Yeah, this is, it's all going to be okay. And then you just look at the world and go, oh, this is really far from okay. Maybe part of why it's far from okay is because everyone's just looking after their own little bit of it. I mean, is there a credible alternative to just trying to work on your own shit? Do you know what I mean? I remember being so worried about this as an adolescent, thinking, you know, what can I offer the world? What can I offer the world? How can I help? How can I fix anything? How can I do anything more than simply be all right, Jack? You know, because we've each got a responsibility, haven't we, to our families, to ourselves, try and work hard, try and make a local difference. And ultimately, it's easy to feel so small and to feel so reduced by global events that just sort of remind us that all crazy shit is happening that we don't seem to have any stake in. Any say in. A huge stake, but no say. This is more than usually rambling, is it? It's probably not. It's actually probably less than usually rambling and more than usually upsetting. So this waffle is, if you're new to this, it's normally cheerier, but it's just kind of a place for me to vent whatever's on my mind. And what's on my mind is, oh, just when everything was coming together, everything seems to be falling apart. But was it Aaron Sorkin wrote that letter to his daughters, which was on the eve of Trump's election, on the dawn of Trump's election?
And I really think you should seek that out. That's good. That's a good way of turning despair into anger. He's a very, very good writer. You know, I mean, I know that some of you will have voted to leave the EU, and I understand that. I'm assuming anyone listening to this has got good reasons for doing that. And I think part of the issue is that we need to stop writing each other off as idiots. You know, it would be awful if the UK... Well, I mean, it's too late now, isn't it? The UK has already become as polarised as the American election system, you know, that kind of red-blue thing. That's happened to us regarding Brexit. Sort of a very funny tweet, which I'm afraid I can't remember, I can't credit it properly. But apparently Brexit is entering the English dictionary. And if so the tweet was along the lines of if they had any balls, they would go Brexit, noun, meaning Brexit. you know, oh, God, what do you know? You know, I think that normally the point at which which in this section of the show that I start saying, you know, it means I've run out of steam. But I think we have to stop writing each other off as idiots. And we've got to think of something. Answers on a postcard, please. I mean, you can always email me, but let's keep this public for now. And let's have one thread. Every time anyone goes to the ComCom Facebook group and starts individually posting different things, what I should have done was, hey, this is the new guest suggestion post. I should have done that, and I will do that. But we've got to keep it organised. I will do a post on the Facebook group for how do you stay happy when the world is going to hell. Is there a solution? Let's talk about that. Let's do it as a community. But I tell you what, just when you think the world is falling to bits, then you see a man who's clearly in his 30s on a bike doing a wheelie down the street for ages. So I guess there's hope.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.